We see the empty shelves at the grocer and watch as farmers dump milk, crush eggs, and plow their crops under. Then we look to the future and ask, will agriculture survive the coronavirus?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1228th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I hold on to some very wonderful memories of my grandparents' farm near the little town of Belfry, Montana. The farm consisted of 320 irrigated and very diversified acres, as well as all the farm animals typically found in children's books. Though the grandparents grew many different crops, their principal crop was always their family. I don't think they ever did make much money, and the money they did make went right back into sustaining the independence of their farm. But for a pair of Olsen boys, it was the richest place on earth to grow up. One might still be able to find a farm like that of the grandparents today by visiting Amish country. Most farmers today are in the business of growing commodities for profit. Many have taken advantage of the economies of scale to grow very big, and in fact, many farmers have moved off the farm to live in a nearby city. Got to thinking about what would have happened to the grandparents' farm had the coronavirus struck while the grandparents were still farming. I don't think it would have changed the farm's activities much at all. Then I got to comparing that thought with what I see happening in farm country consequent to the coronavirus, the dumping of milk, the crushing of eggs, and the plowing under of crops. And I wonder, will agriculture survive the coronavirus? Well, here to help us find some answers, we have Dr. Ellen Bruno, who is a cooperative extension specialist, Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley, and co-author of The Coronavirus and the Food Supply Chain. Dr. Ellen, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you aboard. So, do you remember that day when the apple fell on your head and you decided that you just had to become an ag economist?
You know, there wasn't one day.
There wasn't.
No. I started thinking that I wanted to be an environmental economist, but then while I was at UC Davis getting my graduate degree, I was sort of, my eyes were opened to the interesting dynamics of food production and food supply chains, and I slowly became an ag economist. Not that, you know, agricultural environmental economics are closely linked, and lots of overlapping topics, and I really do consider myself both, but it was definitely at my time in Davis where I just learned how interesting agriculture was and that I wanted to be an economist studying it.
Good. And you are a cooperative extension specialist, which means you extend what you have learned to poor folks like myself, correct?
Yeah, there's a branch of the University of California called Agriculture and Natural Resources that, you know, contributes largely to the, you know, UC's mission to do public outreach in addition to the research and teaching that the UC does in California. So, yes, I'm a cooperative extension specialist, and I do applied research as well as public outreach.
Good. And here to extend to us today. So I'd like to begin just by asking, have you and your associates there at UC Berkeley and throughout the ag economy world, have you ever seen anything like this before? The catastrophic collapse of an economy so quickly?
No. I think this is totally unprecedented. I mean, obviously, I certainly haven't, but my career is also a you know, relatively new compared to some of my colleagues. But I think it's safe to say that they would also agree that this is quite, these are quite unprecedented times that we're experiencing here. And some of the shocks to the food supply chain are really dramatic and kind of unlike others we've seen in the past.
Now, I assume that you, you know, teleconfer with a lot of your associates during the course of this situation. May I ask a kind of an inside question? What do you say to each other when you're talking about it? How do you?
One common thing to refer to when talking about, you know, supply and demand, food-related supply and demand pre-coronavirus, we've just referred to that as normal times. And everything else is abnormal times.
So may we truly live in abnormal times, I guess.
It's what it feels like, right?
Well, certainly does. Well, let's go to the big question. What in the heck happened to us? Everything was going along so good. Full employment. The economy was roaring. Farmers are growing crops and selling them and making money. And within a few days, it seemed like farmers were dumping milk and crushing eggs and plowing their crops under. Your associate there, Pam Rice, described your the coronavirus and the food supply chain kind of in these terms. It's the coronavirus derailed the connection between supply and demand. That's an interesting thing to disconnect, because we're all still hungry.
Right, right.
And yet,
well,
the farmers are dumping food and the shelves are empty. So, wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the major responses to the pandemic has been to, you know, encourage people to shelter in place and you know, close down all non-essential businesses. And so that's had a huge impact on where we can buy food, right?
So there you
go.
So are.
Even though...
And that's,
yeah,
kind of, that's kind of the disconnect then, is that we're all stumped here. Well, let's start with our normal times, because you give an excellent example of how things typically work when they're typically working, which of course they're no longer typically working, but they were a few weeks ago. And it's a, you know, the whole process of supply and demand achieve a place of equilibrium where the supply and the demand meet each other and everybody's happy and things are stable and moving along smoothly. And everybody likes that who is involved in the business, and those who are involved in eating too, because you can buy food. So everything's working. So you describe that as an environment in which everything is regular and predictable, and it's based on this whole, essentially based on just in time to avoid stockouts, which is, would you describe that for us?
Sure. So the regular predictable component here is referring to our consumption patterns. Like if we think about going to the grocery store, and everyone sort of has their pretty regular basket of items they like to purchase, and you know that might act, you know, that might change week to week somewhat, but it sort of evens out across all the consumers. And in such a way that, you know, large grocery stores and small grocery stores can sort of predict what consumers will buy and how much of it, which allows them to stock appropriately in terms of the quantities of items that, that consumers demand in normal times. And you can imagine if you're running a grocery store, you know, it doesn't make a lot of economic sense to stock a lot of goods, you know, somewhere in the back. You know, that takes up space and that could potentially lead to unnecessary waste of food that could have been sold if it were out on the shelves, but it's stockpiled in the back somewhere. So that's not something that is done. So that's sort of what I was referring to in terms of what we were referring to in terms of just in time.
So the grocers essentially want the suppliers to deliver their goods just when they're needed, just in time.
Exactly.
Not too soon and not too late.
Yeah, and it works because consumer demand is generally very predictable.
Right, because we're hungry, and when we're hungry and we have our habits and we live by our habits, and so we are generally very predictable. And that mm-hmm. is the just-in-time nature. And mm-hmm. it's really fine-tuned to avoid stockouts. What's a stockout?
Mm-hmm. Oh, when you can't find a certain item on the shelf, you know. TP, toilet paper, was getting a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks, but other goods as well. I mean, in my own experience, there's been hard to find flour, among other things, and in normal times, we're very accustomed to being able to buy these items anytime we run out and seek to get more of them at the store. But lately we've experienced these stockouts where we go to the grocery store and the shelves are empty of certain things we'd like to buy.
So that's what we avoid by just-in-time buying and selling. Now, I'm not an ag economist by any means. I'm just a dumb Montana boy. But I do know why we ran short of toilet paper. It was really a simple matter. One person sneezed and 1,200 people pooped their pants. And that's what happened to the toilet paper in America. But at any rate, so in normal times, regular and predictable, we all know where the food is. We all know where it's going to be. And it's going to be right there on the shelves just in time for us to buy it. And everything works really smoothly that way. But then we're not in normal times, and something happened. And in very brief terms, what happened was that we were struck by the coronavirus. Nobody really knew what it was. Nobody knew where it came from. Nobody knew anything, except we heard that it could kill millions of people. That's what we were told. And that had a very interesting impact on consumers, us. What did we do? Mm-hmm. We pretty much freaked out. We hunkered down. And some of us ran to the store and bought toilet paper and other things. And then there wasn't any toilet paper on the shelves or other things as well. And that's really the beginning of the story of our extraordinary times, which we could call COVID times, I guess. We as shocked consumers were left wondering what to do. And when we pick it up, we're going to talk about what we did do and how what we did do changed how the food got from where it was produced to where it's consumed. And that's the big story. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we have Dr. Ellen Bruno, who is a cooperative extension specialist with the Department of Ag and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley. And she's going to lead us through the story of our COVID times right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
I think there was a Chinese saying that goes something along the lines of, "May you live in interesting times." Now, I always thought that was a nice thing to wish on somebody, but I understand that it's really a curse. And that's kind of the curse that we're living under right now. We're living in under very interesting times compared to our normal times, which is when everything is very predictable and running smoothly, and we know where the food is, and we know who's making the food. But everything got changed with the COVID virus, because it literally, that the impact of that virus really shocked the nation. And it shocked, it began with us consumers, I guess. Is that right, Dr. Ellen?
Yeah. Whether definitely, consumers have changed the way they're demanding food, be it through their own, you know, fears of interactions with other people, getting takeout or whatever, or because certain restaurants are shut down and other venues that serve food are not serving food right now.
So regardless of where you look, things got changed really quickly. Well, there's like, let's start with consumers. So first thing we did is we started buying comfort foods, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, you know, I personally haven't explored that in the data, but that's something that has been thrown around as a potential explanation. I think there are a lot of different changes to demand that we're experiencing, and one of them might be an increased desire for certain products at the grocery store.
And those are the ones we buy. And I would assume that those things that we can buy and eat and store for a longer period of time would probably be more preferable than things that only last for a very short period of time, like strawberries, for example.
Definitely. Even in my own experiences going to the grocery store, if I'm trying to go less frequently, I'm going to change the bundle of goods that I buy, and maybe I shift away towards less perishable, I shift towards less perishable foods. And maybe buy less, you know, lettuce and strawberries or items like that that might go bad pretty quickly.
Yeah, we just planted them in our garden. We thought, well, if we're going to have something like that, may as well have them in the ground.
Yeah.
And of course, in our changing our buying preferences, we did two major things. One, we turned away from restaurants and schools and those places that I guess serve industrial foods. We just we started eating at home and not eating out.
Right. I think that's the biggest thing here. I mean, definitely consumers are changing the goods that they buy at the grocery store, but the biggest shock here is that there's just more demand at the grocery store.
Yeah,
due to these closures. Mm-hmm.
And that would kind of exacerbate some of the things that we're hoarding, too, because instead of half of us eating out half the time or whatever, we're all eating in and going to the grocery store. So the grocery stores are very much put upon and end up with shortages. Now, grocery stores, you talk about how they manage this situation, which is really quite interesting, because if you're a grocery store and all of a sudden you have twice as many customers as you had before, and all of them kind of want the same kind of thing, the same basic items that they can store for a while and won't have to go to the grocery store so often. So naturally what happens is that they end up with shortages. How does those shortages become manifest up and down the food chain, Dr. Ellen?
Well, oftentimes what we've been seeing at the grocery store, as I'm sure you've experienced as well, is that we've seen just complete shortages of some of these items that are have faced increases in demand, as opposed to price. So we're seeing that price is not allocating scarcity in the way that it might for other goods and services that are demanded and supplied in our economy.
How would that be, though? Say that again, that prices are not governing supply. So it, no matter how much money you have, it's not going to buy the supply. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So when it comes back to the toilet paper example, you know, you get some if it happens to be there and not otherwise, and everyone pays the same price, as opposed to, for example, saying the person who is willing to pay the most for the toilet paper gets it.
Right.
That would be an example of price allocating who gets the toilet paper. or even, you know, the price of the toilet paper changing from week to week for everyone. I mean, in general, these large supermarkets like to practice what's called everyday low pricing, meaning they like to have stable prices for their customers. You don't want to be shocked going week to week to the grocery store, the prices bouncing around. And in striving to maintain stable prices at the grocery store, it means that prices are not being used to allocate.
Ah. So if I want to charge five times more for the toilet paper, some people will buy it, of course. But
a lot of people wouldn't.
But a lot of people wouldn't. That's right. Now, mm-hmm. Why don't grocers like to do that?
Well, one theory is that you don't want to be accused of manipulating customers in the face of an emergency. It could look bad, right?
Yeah. It might result in having olive oil thrown across the store or something like that too. You know, if you charge mm-hmm. five times as much for the toilet paper, people might get upset, mm-hmm. and that might mm-hmm. be reflected on your sales on the other side of the problem. Then, what about what about hoarding or price gouging? Are there laws against price gouging?
I can't really speak to that.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what laws are in place on restrictions of prices how and if that varies across, cities and counties. Yeah.
What about government edicts and proclamations and whatnot then? What about government stepping in and saying, you must sell more toilet paper or else? In your paper, you talk about how oftentimes government regulations can have a unintended consequence where it can actually exacerbate the shortages.
Right. I believe that was more in the context of, regulating some of the food retailers from charging higher prices because the goods were scarce.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're regulated to say, not allow price increases over a certain amount, then that it's eliminating the price signal, which can be helpful in certain contexts. I mean, you could think about if you were a toilet paper manufacturer and all of a sudden you could get twice as much for what you're selling, that's a pretty strong incentive to produce more.
Right.
But if you're sort of right, if there's regulation later farther along the supply chain saying that we can't, prices can't increase to reflect that scarcity, then that signal doesn't get relayed to the manufacturers to then have that incentive to ramp up supply.
That almost sounds like Venezuela, or from what we've read at any rate. Strange things happen when the government starts ordering people to produce more. They end up producing less. And let's go to some of the impacts on the prices of commodities. Let's pick up eggs here, which I found to be very interesting. You have a little chart in your presentation about the difference in prices between March 13th and April 10th, roughly a month, and what happened to the price of eggs when we started shutting down. Now, you have a couple of prices that I found kind of confusing. You have Midwest delivered to warehouse prices, and then you have a California benchmark price. And then you have a national retail price. So what is a Midwest delivered to warehouse prices? Is that just a wholesale price then?
Yeah, that is my understanding.
Okay. And then what would the California benchmark price be?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that.
Well, that's okay. I just noticed that the Midwest delivered to warehouses prices is almost half of what the California benchmark price was. And I was wondering, my goodness, why are California eggs twice as much as Midwest eggs? And I got to thinking, well, maybe there's a climate change tax on California eggs like there is on gasoline. But I'd probably not, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, there are state-specific regulations for, egg-laying hens. And I know, California in particular had recently passed some regulations related to, the size of the cages that hens are kept in.
So maybe there,
are other, not necessarily a carbon related type of thing, but there are those types of factors that do affect wholesale egg prices across different states. There are different regulations that would affect those prices.
Gotcha.
So it's not at all surprising, I think, that the California benchmark would be higher.
Okay, good. Well, there you go. But at any rate, if you look at the month difference in the Midwest, from March 13th, the price was 94 cents a dozen. And April 10th, which is roughly a month later, it's 283, or roughly three times what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Zoom, the price went right through the roof. And the same is true of the California benchmark. And yet the national retail advertised cage-free chicken eggs didn't move at all over that period, of course, of that month. It was 244 in March 13th and 247 in April 10th. So somehow cage-free eggs stayed pretty much the same without going through the roof. Is there any explanation for that?
Well, I think the key thing is not necessarily cage-free, but the fact that those are retail prices. And the fact that retail prices might be moving differently than wholesale prices, which sort of goes back to our previous conversation about the incentive that supermarkets have to keep prices consistent over time, because that's what consumers like to see.
So the retailers then are really bending over backwards and to kind of hold things down for the consumer.
I mean, I think in a lot of cases, yes. I mean, I also want to take a step back and qualify for a second. I mean,
sure.
The prices can be changing for lots of different reasons. And so, looking at these trends, we're just speculating here and thinking about how coronavirus and resulting changes in demand might have been affecting these prices. But of course we're just looking at trends here. So one possible explanation here is that consumers have increased their demand for eggs.
Because we can store them.
So,
right?
They're storable. They're easy to cook.
And they're
easy to make at home.
And they're nutritious.
And with a shift out in demand, we would see higher prices. But they're being sort of managed at the retail level because, supermarkets want to keep consistent prices for whatever reason. And we can see that here pretty clearly in the table.
Good.
From the article.
So those prices were reflected in one big element of the coronavirus times that we're going through, in that consumers went to the grocery store and changed their buying habits. And that had an impact on prices and supply. But that wasn't the real big shift that we made. The real big shift was that we stopped eating out. And as you point out in your paper, that eating out was almost half of the average household's food budget. So we were eating out a lot. And then within a few days, we weren't eating out much at all, not counting the little bit that we do in takeout. So there was a huge change in the food supply chain with respect to all of that food that was going to the restaurant trade and the institutional trade. And that's a major change, and that's what we're going to pick up when we come back from this short break. We are talking with Dr. Ellen Bruno, who is a cooperative extension specialist, Department of Ag and Resource Economics, UC Berkeley, and the co-author of The Coronavirus and the Food Supply Chain. Now, don't you think that's an appropriate radio subject for the Food Chain Radio Show? I do. That's why we're here. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it was a major change in how we went about feeding ourselves. No more sitting out in the conviviality of restaurants. We were eating at home by ourselves or our family. Big change. And then, Dr. Ellen Bruno, what happened to all of that food that was headed for the restaurants and the institutions and whatnot?
Well, a lot of it, well, suppliers had to figure out something else to do with that food. In some cases, producers might be able to get that food that was slotted originally for restaurants and other food service outlets to try to get it to retail, where all the demand is now. But for certain producers that are specialized in their operations to serve food service, they've been out of luck.
It's completely out of luck, I would think, because where do you send the food if there's nobody to buy it or process it or cook it or prepare it? There's no place for it to go. Is that why we're seeing farmers dumping milk and crushing eggs and plowing under their crops and euthanizing their farm animals?
In some cases, yeah. They weren't able to, you know, these shocks to demand have been so abrupt that it's been quite challenging for a lot of agricultural producers to respond quickly enough. The short term horizon, it's difficult to respond.
And yet they had to respond, had to do something because their production kept going. They kept producing the crops and they kept having them ready for sale, but there was nowhere to sell them. So they had to do something. And that's why we see, you know, the frightening devastation of commodities out in farm country and for farmers and for processors. And there's nothing they can do, is there? I mean, how do you go about changing your business plan from serving giant institutions to, you know, selling at the farmer's market? My goodness, what do you do?
Right. It depends a lot on the product. I mean, certain commodities, it might be easier than others. For example, if we were to think about processing tomatoes, those are the tomatoes that go into, you know, cans and tomato paste cans and jars of tomato sauce and ketchup and those types of tomatoes as opposed to fresh tomatoes. They can be stored, you know, in warehouses for a while. So, if you're a processor making gallons of tomatoes to go to restaurants, that are no longer buying them now that the restaurants are closed, that food isn't going to waste. But it's still, that doesn't mean it doesn't have an impact on those producers and those processors. But in terms of, you know, compared to these stories we've read about plowing over produce that isn't getting sold or dumping milk or these types of things, it depends. It largely depends on the commodity.
Now, how do you go about, or do you go about, if you're in the business of supplying commodities to these giant institutions, what kind of business planning are you doing?
Yeah. Well, part of it depends on, you know, what sort of investment you have to make in order to switch your production and packaging lines and everything from food service to retail. And so in some cases, that could be a big investment if when you're producing for food service, you know, there's a very specific machinery and that sort of thing in order to produce packages of that size. I mean, you can think about, I think of milk cartons as being a good example. Think about all the little school cafeteria milk cartons versus the gallon you might look for at the grocery store. You can't just overnight switch your product line to go from cafeteria size school lunch milk cartons to grocery store gallons.
And I suspect there's a lot of rules and regulations with respect to different labeling, too.
Right. That would be another element of this that enters in. But, yeah, so largely the way I'm thinking about it is that, you know, it's a big investment to switch if you're specialized for food service. And whether or not that investment is worthwhile depends on how long you expect your food service clients to not be demanding, you know, how long will restaurants be closed and all the sort of food away from home.
So that kind of gets us to the $64 trillion question, doesn't it? How long is this going to last?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not a question I can answer.
And, well, it's not a question that anybody can answer.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we're facing the three big challenges that you suggest that we have to face, the first one you lay on the table is how do we rearrange production so that our supplies more readily fit the market that we're looking at? And the big question there is, well, how long will this situation last? And that'll have some determination on whether I switch or just hunker down and wait. And looking around, I can see nobody who has an answer for that. Certainly not the medical establishment and certainly not the political establishment. And so nobody knows. So that's the great unknown right there. The other big issue is farm labor. And how we go about managing farm labor. You suggest the possibility that, well, now with so many businesses closed, there might be more farm labor available. But I'm looking around and I'm seeing the people who are no longer work in restaurants are going to be all that interested in working in the fields on a farm.
Why do you say that?
Having worked on a farm long enough, I know what kind of work is involved, and it's a lot of hard work. And it's not the kind of work that restaurant people are, you know, when you work in a restaurant, it's a people business that you're doing there. And when you're working on a farm, you're working with nature, working with, you know, a lot of adversities, and whatnot that you would not experience necessarily in a restaurant. So I'm just wondering if there really would be more farm labor available in the short term, maybe in the long term, but not so certain about the short term. The most frightening thing about short-term farm labor is how you protect them from the coronavirus.
Yeah, which is another thing that I think is, produce commodity specific, because the way that labor enters into the production and processing of different, you know, food items varies across items. And for some, it might be easier to, some that are inherently sort of less labor intensive, it'll be easier to adjust than others.
Mm-hmm. And what about processing facilities? Well, I mean, out in the field, you know, farm workers can typically separate each other from the requisite 6 feet. But if you're on a production line in a processing facility, you're working pretty mm-hmm. close with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding in certain cases. I mean, I think meat packing has gotten a lot of attention in that regard recently. Not something that I know a ton about, but yeah, I think that's a very real concern that, you know, adjustments will have to be made in terms of processing and the proximity of people in the process. And even with, there are instances that are components of the food supply chain processing aside that I think are, there are elements where, you know, risk of an outbreak is there and maybe we wouldn't be thinking about it otherwise. And I'll give you one example because I was just learning about this the other day, bringing it back to processing tomatoes. I had known that processing tomatoes were mechanically harvested, and I sort of thought, oh, okay, this is probably a commodity that isn't at high risk of, you know, of an outbreak in labor. But then I learned that there is a lot of labor involved in transplanting tomatoes from greenhouses to the fields. And so even for something that we might think is, you know, largely mechanical and doesn't involve a lot of people, there's still a dimension of it when it comes to moving the tomatoes from the greenhouse to the field that involves a lot of human contact. And I think that could be, there are instances with many different crops and commodities where without knowing exactly how all of these different commodities work, there are elements of the food supply chain everywhere where there's human contact.
Well, that's for sure. And then, you know, the final element you bring up, the final big challenge is how do we ramp up farm production of the items that are now in high demand? And you mentioned that one of the key considerations is a concept called income elasticity. What does that mean?
Yeah. So the income elasticity is an economic sort of parameter that captures the way that we demand food as our income changes. So
if we're really broke, we're not going to order the lobster and the filet mignon. We're going to order the cheeseburger, right?
Yeah. And in thinking, I mean, in particular, in this article, we were talking about the income elasticity in the context of the longer term horizon and changes to food demand as we look farther in the future past this sort of initial shocks to supply and demand due to the virus itself and looking ahead to, you know, a recession and changes in our food demand as a result of a recession and having less income. And so we know that demand for different products, the change in demand for different products as our income changes varies across these different products. And sort of just like what you brought up with the filet mignon and lobster, we can take that a step further and think about how, you know, even once restaurants are fully open, if we're in a recession and people in general have less income, you demand that, you know, people will go to restaurants with less, will go less often than they did prior in a booming economy.
In that respects, our restaurant industry has been is hit with a big whammy in the fact that they've been shut down. But when they do come back, there's another whammy waiting for them in the fact that nobody has as much money to spend as they had before when times were good and the economy was roaring.
Exactly.
And so the restaurant trade really has some survival things to think about, but not only the restaurant trade, but everybody who provides food for the agriculture that provides food for the restaurant and institutional trade will also have something to think about as well. Well, Dr. Ellen Bruno, the final big question, will agriculture survive the coronavirus?
Well, I'm pretty sure that people will still be hungry even after the coronavirus. The demand will still be there. I think that there will be changes, changes to the food supply chain, changes to agriculture and the way it operates. And some of those changes will last past coronavirus. But in general, yeah, we're going to continue to demand food, and agriculture as an industry is very adaptable, and they'll continue to supply food.
There you go. You write, over the next weeks and months, there will be surely more uncertainty, controversy, and troubles, but nothing in the data or the underlying economics suggests there will be a lack of healthy, safe food available. Well, that's good news. What about the potential of other shocks, though? And I'm thinking about how sudden this one came on and out of the blue. And I'm just wondering, my goodness, if there are more coronaviruses out there? I don't know. Those are the things that really are frightening. But today we'll take your optimism to heart and relish it and take it home with us. Want to thank you, Dr. Ellen Bruno, for joining us today. And folks, I want you to remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Dr. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Pleased.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.